This is the state of things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. On its website, RTI International describes itself as a not-for-profit contract research institute dedicated to improving the human condition. Spread across 180 acres in Research Triangle Park, the organization has ties to four universities in the area. In the past, it's been best known for research in the areas of AIDS, healthcare, transportation, and energy. But RTI also works in social service and international development. And in 2003, RTI won a contract to build local governments in Iraq. Today on The State of Things, we're talking about RTI's local governance project in Iraq, and we'd like you to join the conversation. The number to call is 1-877-962-9862. Joining us in the studio today are two reporters who have covered RTI. Kevin Bigas is a reporter for the Winston-Salem Journal, and Jay Price is a reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. Welcome to both of you. And we're also joined by Patrick Gibbons, Director of Corporate Communications and a spokesperson for RTI. And Patrick Gibbons, I want to start by just asking you, how does an organization known primarily or that was known primarily for scientific research end up helping build local governments in Iraq?
Well, we have 30 years of experience with this type of thing in the international development community. So when the project came along, or the need came along, RTI actually had quite a bit of internal debate. Was this something we really wanted to do? Because it is a bit of a stretch for our organization. That said, we do have the resources, we do have the experience, and there certainly was a need to help create local governments throughout the country of Iraq if they wanted to have a successful chance at building a democratic society there. So we went ahead and competed for that project.
All right, but what other projects has RTI been involved in abroad that is similar to Iraq, and is the big difference here, has RTI ever done this in a war zone?
We've done it post-conflict in Kosovo. We're active currently in 30 different countries around the world with international development-type projects. Now, typically, we are much more into workforce development, economic assistance or economic decentralization, and local governments, which is really the decentralization of post-centralized democratic or post-centralized governments post-war, or decentralizing government efforts.
Well, let me turn to Kevin Bigas here. Kevin, in your reporting, I see you want to jump in here, but I also want you to give us an idea of what RTI's work looks like on the ground in Iraq.
First, I'd say that RTI was the only bidder on the contract, in part because of two other people that USAID approached declined to even bid.
Do you know why?
I don't know exactly why. I've been told by a number of people that the other companies just thought it was too enormous a task. There were really severe... USAID asked RTI to have, I think, about 2,000 people on the ground within the first 8 to 10 months, open up offices in 18 provinces. It was very challenging, and that was even before the violence started picking up.
Right, and we should say this is a contract from the U.S. Agency for International Development, which we'll probably end up referring to as USAID. But what are you seeing on the ground? What does this local governance project look like? What does it mean?
You know, I was there in the summer of 2003, so that's a long time ago. In Iraqi political terms, that's light years away. Even then, I was seeing in the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad a lot of uncertainty and dissension over which way humanitarian projects would go, who's really in charge, is the military in charge, is the contractor in charge, is the CPA, which was the Coalition Provisional Authority, in charge, what role, you know, do individual Iraqis have? And it got more and more difficult. Our reporting showed that the challenges as 2003 went on and 2004 went on, RTI, I don't believe, had a free hand to just implement their program. There were other people.
And then that program, again, is basically putting together local governments, getting those local governments to handle things like services, water, sewer, electricity. Is that right, Patrick?
Right. It's a combination of things. We are working, we picked up from the military civil affairs teams the responsibility for helping organize councils. To date, or I guess I should say early on in the project, we help establish more than 700 councils throughout Iraq, and those would be everything from district councils to city councils to provincial councils. At one time, we were active with project offices throughout 17 of Iraq's 18 provinces. We still maintain programs in many of those areas, but most of those are carried out through local Iraqi nationals who were trained in the first year or the initial months of the project and have since continued those efforts. And of course, the whole effort in Iraq from USAID is to develop local capacity for governance. So that's really in line with the mission that was established for us.
Jay Price, in your work in Iraq, you saw RTI on the ground. Did that local government, did that local capacity building, is that being accomplished? Was it being accomplished when you were there?
To some degree. I mean, you have to say that about any aspect of reconstruction there. It is not like doing work here in any way, shape, or form. And in fact, doing overseas work, doing NGO work anywhere is inherently inefficient when you compare it to McDonald's. There's no way you can look at this and say, we'll spend 1.37 man hours on this particular task, training this particular type of person to do this, when you've got to factor in things like security costs. What I looked at mostly when I was on the ground there was riding around having a look at the other side, not just the training of people running the garbage department or the water and sewer plants, or people who do budgeting. But you know, that's one half of local government, the staff side. The other side of it is elected folks, appointed folks, the folks who make policy. And I rode around with one of their people and watched how that was done, watched these meetings in action, and watched what she was doing to kind of teach them what local governance was about. You know, democracy is kind of a strange term to be used there. It's a rough and ready form of democracy. But
so, I mean, you know, I'd like to hear Kevin Bigas's take on this too. And I'll start with you first, though, Jay. How receptive were, you know, the people receiving this kind of guidance from RTI? How receptive were Iraqis?
They're keenly receptive. That doesn't mean they're keenly receptive to Bush or our administration or some of the things that they say. They're keenly receptive to taking charge of their own fate. One of the neighborhood councils I looked at was the Awadi neighborhood in central Baghdad. And you know, after the meeting, I talked to several of the folks that were on this particular council, and maybe they don't quite understand the bureaucracy of democracy, you know, how things go up the channels and then back down the channels. You know, you've got a request, it's a budget request for something. It takes a while, and they were struggling with that concept. But I said, why do you want to do this? And they said, you know, your life is at risk here. And they said, they were pretty clear, I need this done for my neighborhood. I need that sewer pumped off the street so the kids aren't getting sick. And we want to make our neighborhood better.
Kevin Bigas?
Everyone I spoke to for our recent series on RTI agreed that they were welcomed in most places in the beginning, sometimes very warmly welcomed. A lot of Iraqis really appreciated these jobs to do something constructive to help build their country. But then as late 03 and early 04, the security situation got worse and worse, and RTI started to be literally targeted by some of the insurgent forces, especially Muqtada Sadar, who is different from what's going on.
The Shiite leader, right?
Yeah, the young Shiite leader in the south. And I think one could say that it was a lot of rumor and innuendo, but yet it was a fact on the ground that people were starting to accuse RTI of being a Zionist organization or a CIA front operation, and attacks started to increase, you know, whether it's throwing a grenade over the wall of a compound or rocket attacks or AK-47 attacks. Our reporting found that the company struggled to deal with that, and it's almost an impossible situation. I mean, what do you do when you're faced with that kind of rumor and innuendo in a war zone, in such a volatile situation?
My understanding is there's some dispute as to whether RTI workers were targets or just kind of caught up, unfortunately, in the maelstrom of violence that's going on in Iraq. Patrick Ibbins, dispute Kevin's take on it?
I don't think it's so much a dispute. I mean, you could split hairs over it, but a typical label for any organization that is not on your side in that part of the world is they're Zionist. I think what we're really talking about is people who were against change, people who stood to lose through democracy and democracy programs. So I don't think it was directly targeted at RTI so much. It was targeted at reconstruction efforts in a general sense. Now, in some parts of the country, because we were spread out so far, we were the only ones they could target. I mean, and that's the nature of the work that we do. When we go into a country, we are working in very small teams with nationals to develop capacity. We are a very soft target, despite our efforts at security. I mean, and we've had to increase those to some extent. But I don't think we were specifically targeted, and most people did welcome us.
Could I read you an excerpt from one of the internal security memos we obtained that were sent out to RTI workers? This is February 18th. And quote, "However, there have been specific threats against RTI as an organization. The most common theme is to accuse the RTI of being a Zionist CIA organization. This is a common theme throughout the Mideast used against Mideast firms." And then it goes on to say, "A number of staff members have voiced the opinion that we should publish papers and advertise RTI's real purpose for being in Iraq. There is merit in their proposals. However, I'm not sure if public announcements would convince the population, as many people firmly believe the CIA has its hand
in
it." And
Kevin, this is explain clearly and quickly who this is a memo from and who is it to.
This is to all members of the local government team in Iraq from the security team leader for RTI's in the USAID project. And also in terms of whether individuals were targeted, here's RTI's official report to USAID for September about one individual.
Actually, hold up on that because we're about to go to a break. And I want to quickly, just in 10, 15 seconds or so, Jay, you know, is security, in your estimation, derailing the project that RTI has undertaken here?
It's certainly hindered it, and they made no secret about that. They said it was making life difficult as much as almost a year ago. They, you know, clearly you can't operate as well when you have to put on a lot more security.
Well, when we get back, perhaps we'll take up the question at what point do security concerns override the mission of democracy building? This is The State of Things. We're talking today about RTI International and its local governance project in Iraq. We're joined by two reporters, Kevin Bigas of the Winston-Salem Journal and Jay Price of the Raleigh News and Observer, also joined by Patrick Gibbons of RTI, taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Just ahead, we'll talk more about RTI, Iraq, and the reconstruction. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. We're talking today about the North Carolina-based Research Triangle Institute, RTI International. Since April of 2003, the organization has been working in Iraq on a local governance project under a contract with the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, or USAID. And we're joined by two reporters, Kevin Bigas of the Winston-Salem Journal and Jay Price of the Raleigh News and Observer, also joined by Patrick Gibbons of RTI. Kevin Bigas, I just want you to pick up where you left off. You were reading this report that was put out by RTI.
Yeah, it's a monthly report to USAID, and as far as one of their workers who was killed, it says, quote, "On September 18th, a member of the Civic Dialogue Program headquarters team was assassinated. A colleague who was also threatened went into hiding. Both staff members had been working on a series of conferences aimed at increasing the participation of women in the political process. In response, the four planned conferences have been collapsed into one." So, you know, no one's saying that this was RTI's fault, or perhaps even that they could do anything about it. I mean, Iraqis, anyone who's working for the coalition is a target over there. But we found that there was evidence that just because RTI was there, people started to treat them as if they were part of a military operation.
Patrick Evans, you did say that, to your knowledge, nobody has been targeted necessarily that's working with RTI. I wanted to give you a chance to at least address that report and tell us, you know, what you think. Does this raise any questions about whether RTI should be doing what it's doing or whether it's prepared to handle such an atmosphere?
Well, again, there's a number of issues at play here. First of all, the Iraqis who work with coalition forces or with reconstruction efforts in general are, of course, doing so at their great risk to their personal safety and their lives, and even their families in some cases. They choose to get involved because it's the future of their country that is at stake. The case that he's referring to specifically, and I am familiar with it, this woman was a very outspoken in her community about change and on women's issues. So I don't dispute at all that she was targeted. I think she was targeted more because she stood for change, for women's rights in a country where those are foreign concepts. So we mourn her loss. I mean, really, she was a true patriot in the real sense of the word on behalf of the Iraqi people, and she was working for democratic change in their country. I would also add that there have been several others, three others that we know of, who have worked on our project. Many of them came to us from Coalition Provisional Authority, or they were translators from the military. So they were known in their communities as agents of change, agents of democracy, and I think we should pay tribute to them as opposed to splitting hairs over why, in fact, they were targeted.
Let's bring Tom Cook into the conversation now. Tom Cook worked at RTI from 1976 to 1999, and after he retired, he became an independent international development advisor. And in March of 2004, Tom Cook went to Iraq to evaluate RTI's project there. He's now a visiting professor at Duke's Terry Sanford Institute of Public Policy. Tom Cook, thanks for being with us.
Hello.
So you went on. Well, you went to Iraq under a contract with USAID to evaluate RTI's program. What were you evaluating, and what did you find?
Well, we were looking at the local governance project that RTI had, along with several subcontractors to RTI that were doing various things in the 18 governance of Iraq, from civil society building to trying to set up, or as they say, stand up local councils, and training them in things like budgeting and financial management, things like that. But I think, let me just comment on the security issue that was mentioned. I think it's the fact that some of the people were targeted, or there was some feeling that RTI was involved with the military, was understandable, because RTI was working very closely with the military. And military commanders were, in a sense, controlling what happened in each of the governance. They were the main supreme authority in those governance, and RTI staff worked closely with the military people. And so I think it's probably understandable that there was some feeling that RTI was working in collaboration with the military, because they were, in fact, working closely with the military.
Actually, let me turn to Jay Price and maybe go around the table. But Jay, I want to talk about this, kind of parallel work that RTI is doing and the military is doing. The military has civil affairs battalions that are probably doing some work that's similar to RTI. But my question is, what about interference? I remember reading in one of the articles an Iraqi American who went back to work with RTI talked about the influence the provisional authority was having on the makeup of local councils. In other words, to what extent was the U.S. government getting in the way of the work that RTI was supposed to do?
I didn't see that. Nevertheless, I mean, there were 700 plus local governments they were working with. It was mix and match. Everywhere you looked, things were different, done differently. And in some places, RTI wasn't operating. I think in one town I went into, the council I sat in with had stood itself up in kind of a vacuum of power as half Sunni and half Shiite. The military was working with them, wasn't calling the shots on who was on that particular council, because they didn't apparently at that point have any intelligence that there were insurgents on the council. Military is known to yank people off of councils for various reasons, and that was, one of them if they had trouble with some of the folks on it. But I didn't see any of that.
Kevin Bigas?
I think that, in fact, the military is very, very heavily involved with the councils, and that they were, in some cases, was reported to me when I was there. I was there in March for about 5 weeks. And the military, to say the military wasn't involved with setting up the council is simply inaccurate, because it was very heavily involved with it. And as a matter of fact, they had to go through what they called a refresher process back in, I guess it was in April, May, to try to reestablish the credibility of these councils, because in many cases the people in the communities looked at them as being really a product of the U.S. military and not something that was set up by the people in the area. So I think it's really not accurate to say the military was not involved with the councils. They were very heavily involved with the councils, and the military commander in that area, in a particular area, played a very key role. And so I think it's understandable in a sense that there would have been, as shown in some of the surveys that were done, quite a bit of suspicion of the councils in terms of their independence and their ability to really do things independently of the U.S. military.
I would agree with that for the most part, except, again, the one council I went in, of course, the military was heavily involved with it. They were in negotiating with them, talking with them about, lists of what their civil affairs guys could do for this particular council. But this one wasn't broke. They did not stand this one up. These councils weren't a uniform product. They were different everywhere you go. And in this case, it was a strange animal. But yeah, the military was heavily involved in most of these, if not all.
And Kevin Bigas, I'd like to ask you if that military involvement or provisional authority involvement, if you want to call it, is somehow hurting the efforts of RTI.
We talked to a lot of former RTI employees who were very surprised by what they found on the ground. They almost without exception went in with a lot of enthusiasm. They were well-trained people. The local commuters were often receptive, and it put some of the RTI team leaders and workers in a very difficult position because on one hand you can't say no to the military, which was the occupying governing force then. It's also very hard to build credibility when you try and say no to individuals in a community. But some of the decisions had no answers. For example, Muqtada Sadar, the young Shia cleric, RTI set up some local councils in Sadr City in Baghdad. We were told they got off to a good start. Then Muqtada Sadar's people started complaining. They said, well, we had our own councils in place before you came, and here you've come and imposed them. Well, that's true to a sense, but Muqtada Sadar's councils had no women on them. They went and asked every male head of a household, who do you want to be on the local council? Now, that's a very hard thing. Now, I don't know if you can say who's right there. Is Muqtada Sadar right that they appointed people but there were no women? Is that representative? Or is RTI and the U.S. government right that bringing women into the process but kicking out Muqtada Sadar's people is right? That's a very hard one to call.
And Patrick Evans, I want to make sure you get a chance to address this. I mean, have you or any RTI employees who have been working in Iraq been surprised by the involvement of the military or the provisional authority? Has there been interference?
Well, I think just the comments preceding this show you that we're starting to approach the complexity of the situation in Iraq. Every one of these councils is different. The environment itself is very dynamic. The people who went to Iraq, be they military, civilian, international development, or contractors, found that a lot of things were ad hoc. The military civil affairs teams, when they inherited what they inherited throughout Iraq, did their best to organize community leaders. In many cases, those community leaders may have been people who weren't necessarily representative of that area. So over time, as RTI transitioned in and others transitioned in, we did our best to readjust and create, albeit again ad hoc, democratic local governance. So that's what you're seeing there. I think the other thing that's important when you talk about security and the relationship with the military is I think we all understand that real democracy can only exist where there is security. So people who are used to working in international development are very much used to working out on their own, working with locals. Well, that simply is not possible in a non-permissive environment. I think most of us plan for a post-conflict reconstruction effort. But as we've all experienced, particularly since April, we are to some extent in mid-conflict. That has changed the dynamics for everyone. So when Kevin says people went over very optimistic about making a difference in a new democratic Iraq, and the people in Iraq were saying, yes, do that for us, I think there was a lot of enthusiasm, and I think people took that. As that has changed over time, a lot of people have gotten discouraged and left. They don't like to go out with bodyguards. They don't like to ride around in armored cars. It's not what they're used to. Is it necessary? It absolutely is necessary, as is the work that we continue to do throughout the country.
Did then RTI miscalculate the amount of conflict, the amount of security they'd be facing, or are they the victim of miscalculation by the U.S. government? Kevin Bigas.
RTI was chosen for a contract that was drawn up by USAID, and when that contract was audited later by the Inspector General of USAID, they said, look, this was largely guesswork. USAID didn't really know what to expect in Iraq. They had no baseline data. It wasn't a situation like Ukraine or Poland where there was a lot more information. So RTI was given a basic game plan, a work plan, that was drawn up in January, February, March, before the war even started. So it in no way anticipated what happened.
Tom Cook, I mean, I'm glad we're now back to this issue of security. It's an unavoidable one, and it's one that's probably taking a lot of resources. I'm wondering, to what extent do you know, is RTI having to devote too much of its resources to security?
I don't know what the exact figure is of the amount of money that's being spent on security. I heard numbers of 30 to 35% of contractors' contracts were being spent on security. And I think that the point was made, this was not a post-conflict. I mean, this is a war zone, and it has to be seen in that light. In my own view, having been there, I think RTI shouldn't have been in there. I mean, I think that it was probably a year or two premature for them to be there trying to do what they were trying to do. I mean, some of the things they were doing, for example, training people in budgeting and financial management and so forth, you know, you can do that because it's not impacted so much by security issues. But a lot of the other stuff, the civil society and so-called democracy building and trying to get people setting up local councils and so forth, I think was pretty unrealistic in light of the environment that they were having to work in. And I think that they were... The other thing that needs to be said is that RTI was under the control of the Coalition Provisional Authority. It was a USAID contract, but the CPA called the shots. And so one of the complaints that I heard was from RTI staff was how they were being jerked around in terms of what they were doing. And they would be told that you're going to do the civil society work, and then they'd be not, and after a few months they said, no, stop that, you're going to do this, this is the activity you're going to do, and then after a short period of time they were stopped again, and no, you're going to do this. And so it was very frustrating to people in the field because they felt that they were getting you know, conflicting signals, and it was unclear exactly what they should be focusing on because the focus kept changing. And and the other thing that I'd like to get back to this issue of the trust, or somebody mentioned that, is one of the things we found is that is a pretty deep and abiding distrust by the Iraqis, and the reason for that, from what they told us, was that they didn't feel like they were part of the process, that this was something that was handed to them or imposed upon them, and that they really were not key to the process involved.
Is that the result of anecdotes, or is this an actual survey done well, according to scientific
it's
methods?
It's in their own, I mean, RTI did some surveys that indicated that. And to their credit, they were very, very candid surveys, but I interviewed people there in the street and in various governance that I was in, and that kept coming up over and over, this fact that they didn't feel like that this was something that was their doing, but rather was being imposed on them. An example of that is the so-called Constitution, or I don't know what the exact term of it is, but it's anyways in March. This was passed towards the end of March, and it was a supposedly a provisional document, but it was administrative law.
Let me hold you up for a second because I don't want to move away from security too far right now. I did want to ask Kevin, because now you had a higher figure than Tom quoted in terms of percentage, the amount that RTI is spending on security. And I just wanted you to address that and tell us how you came up with your figure.
Well, that was a quote from a team leader in the northern region, but it's in line with what I heard from other people. I mean, it changes in different region and different time, but when USAID Inspector General looked at another contract, a reconstruction contract recently, they found that security costs were eating up 49%. This was Bearing Point. And listen to this comparison. When the contract had been designed, Bearing Point and its cost proposal thought they would have to spend about $894,000 for security costs during the first year of the project. What they actually had to spend was $37 million. So it went from an estimate of roughly $1 million to $37 million for another reconstruction contractor because the situations were so different.
But that just represents a response to the situation. Patrick Gibbons from RTI, I mean, is that a failure in planning, or is it just a response to the situation?
Well, first I'd like to say that Kevin's figure is absurd, and he knows that. And we've
I disagree with that.
And we've informed him of that. We've been audited.
I disagree with that.
Okay, so we know that there's a discrepancy,
and I can lay it out in a number of ways. But first of all, if he was getting information from somebody in the north, that's the most peaceful part of the country, their costs would be the lowest of anyone. That's just kind of one. Two, as we've stated over a number of occasions, our costs for security are in line with those of every other reconstruction contractor. USAID Administrator Mr. Andrew Natsios has said those costs are 25%. Those are consistent with our costs. I would tell you over the life of the program, they're actually lower than that. We've been audited five times. We've provided very detailed amounts that we've spent on every part of this program five times, and no one has found anything inappropriate about the expenses. And again, the bottom line is our costs are consistent with those of every other contractor doing work in Iraq. Is it expensive? Absolutely. Is it a dangerous environment? Absolutely. Is it necessary to expend those resources to do the right thing for the people who are working in this environment? Absolutely. And I guess you just have to understand that if you're going to be there, you have to bear those costs.
Jay Price, I just want to ask, because you've reported on RTI being on track despite security issues. Give us your take on this.
Well, the security thing is hitting everybody over there. I think in March 2004, I reported that the CPA Inspector General said security costs for most of the organizations operating there had risen to the point at that time about 10 to 15% of the expenditure on reconstruction, that they actually threatened the reconstruction at a 10 to 15% rate if they didn't get more money pumped in. Certainly, RTI's costs, I think, would have risen, and from what I'm given to understand, it is somewhere in the 25% range. But
can they do the job, though?
It would not have risen commensurate with the threat because they've changed the nature of the way they do business. They're keeping more people on bases and letting the local hires do a lot of the work.
Great. We're talking about RTI International and its involvement with the reconstruction effort in Iraq. Joined by Kevin Bigas, reporter for the Winston-Salem Journal, and Jay Price, reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, also joined by Patrick Gibbons of RTI, and by Tom Cook, a former evaluator of RTI's Iraq project. Just ahead, more of your calls at 1-877-962-9862 on The State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. We're talking this hour about RTI International and its local governance project in Iraq. RTI is a research institute based in Research Triangle Park, and it's been in Iraq since the spring of 2003. Its original government contract to do work there ends this March, and the project has been open to other bidders. We're joined by Kevin Bigas, reporter for the Winston-Salem Journal, and Jay Price, reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. And we're also joined by Patrick Gibbons of RTI International and Tom Cook, a former evaluator of RTI's Iraq project. And we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Kevin Bigas, you've been reporting on this, and you've been...
Just a quick thing on security costs. It's easy to settle. We made a Freedom of Information request to USAID, also asked RTI to release the budgetary information. You know, they don't have to release every single detail, but, you know, let us put it in writing, release the information. What's going to security? How much has Custer Battles been paid and other contractors? And that settles it. And we stand by our reporting and we stand by our figures, but if there's a disagreement, there's an easy way to resolve it by letting the taxpayers know how this taxpayer-funded contract money is being spent.
Patrick Gibbons, I mean, any concern that a resistance on RTI's part to reveal anything about the financial terms of its contracts would be perceived as having something to hide? Or,
well, the security costs were provided in Mr. Bigas, consistent with the other contractors, which have been estimated at 25%. We do not go into the costs of our program, any program expenses, on this or any other of our contracts. It's a competitive environment, and we don't release those business details. I do understand his perspective. This is a very expensive project, and, of course, it's taxpayer-funded. Clearly, there's a lot of interest. We've provided all of our information, the very, very detailed information, to every federal agency and accounting request that's been received, and that is the proper mechanism through which we provide that information to the taxpayers.
All right, I'd like to bring in a caller now. John is on the line from Willow Spring. And John, I believe you were in Iraq with the military?
Yes, I was. I was a company commander in Northern Diyala Province.
Well, what's your comment?
Well, I would like to say that RTI would seem to be doing a good job. Where we were was a multi-ethnic region, Arab, Kurd, and Turk, and the city council seemed to work well with us initially, and as we came closer to the transition back in the June time frame, we backed out of the process and instructed them that the RTI would be assisting, and they seem to be doing a very good job, in our opinion.
Well, thanks for calling, John. Tom Cook, I want to turn to you because you were there to evaluate RTI's work. Did your findings match up with what John just told us?
Well, I think that the difficulty was in them trying to do a lot of the stuff they were trying to do in that environment. I mean, the question about security cost really kind of avoids the question of whether or not they should have been trying to do the kind of work they were doing, which works when you're in a secure environment, not in an insecure environment. And so I think that one of the conclusions that I came to was that the type of work they were trying to do was just inappropriate for that environment, which was a war zone. And I don't fault RTI at that. I mean, they had a contract and they had deliverables and they had to produce, and they were that's what they were given, so they had to do it. I mean, it's a contract, so they're held to those terms. But I think that the whole environment was such that the contract itself, what they were asked to do didn't make sense. I mean, it was just you can't do that kind of work effectively in that kind of an environment. And so I think that's the real issue. And I think it needs to be remembered that there had been things written about this stating that this would happen, and they were ignored by the military and the Defense Department. So they went into an environment which was to do things that, in my view, were inappropriate because they were told to do it under the terms of their contract. And I think that's the real issue, is whether or not they should have been trying to do those things. But I think that they didn't really have a choice. I mean, they bid on the contract, they won it, and it was under their terms of the contract they had to do it. But I don't think that the activities made sense in light of the environment they were in, and I think that's borne out today. I mean, it's from my understanding, and maybe Patrick can...
Let me jump in here, Tom. I want to bring in someone now who represents the organization that gave the contract to RTI from U.S. Agency for International Development. And by the way, John, thanks for that call. RTI International has been working in Iraq under the contract from USAID. The Iraq Project's the agency's, that is the USAID's, largest reconstruction project since the Marshall Plan post-World War II. Jim Kunder is USAID's Assistant Administrator for Asia and the Near East, and he joins us from his office in Washington. Hi, Jim.
How are you, sir?
Fine, thanks very much. Well, start by describing the terms of RTI's original contract in Iraq.
I'm glad I've had a chance. I've been in my office listening to WUNC on the program. I think it's been a very useful exchange. I was going to say, I'm glad you asked that question, because I thought the one issue that maybe hadn't come out is why on earth we were doing this with the taxpayers' money in the first place. Our thinking in Iraq was that this had been a highly centralized dictatorship. And one of the steps we had to take to move it towards democracy, in addition to the elections that are scheduled for this Sunday across Iraq, was to get some decentralization of the government structures and more participation by the local citizens. In North Carolina, we've got 100 ways where local citizens can be involved in democracy, grassroots democracy. You got the local water boards and sewer boards and school boards and county government. But in Iraq, it had been such a centralized system, we wanted to get local councils established. We wanted to get essentially ineffective and vestigial local government organizations into the process, because this is how democracy works. You want 1,000 voices, 1,000,000 voices affecting government decision-making. And this is what we asked RTI to do. And with all of the points that have been made here in the last 45 minutes, our sense is that the contract has succeeded. We've got a lot of bright, engaged men and women across Iraq involved in government and democracy who wouldn't have been involved before.
Now, Jim Kunder, my understanding is that RTI, at the time that the first contract was awarded, was the only organization in a position to handle it. But now the contract is being opened up to bidders. Why?
This is an interesting question. You know, what has happened, there's been a vigorous debate in Washington that I think actually the taxpayers would be proud of, but within the administration and with the Congress, between two competing objectives that the government has. Number one, any government contract, we try to get as much full and open competition. We try to get as many bidders as possible so the taxpayers will get the best product at the lowest price. But second, in Iraq, in a war zone, we wanted to be very careful to be quick with our response. When our soldiers took the ground and entered Baghdad, we knew that very soon after that, they were going to be looking over their shoulders to look for the health experts and the education experts, electricity experts, and government and democracy experts who were going to help them do their job in Iraq. And so what we did was we debated that issue. And in the first go-around, when RTI won the contract, we erred on the side of quick response. We limited the number of bidders that were allowed to bid on the contract because, this being the U.S. government, truth in advertising, it takes a while to get a full and open government contract bid out on the street. This time around, after 2 years and after some initial successes, as you've been discussing, we erred in the other way. We wanted to make sure we get full and open competition. So we gave RTI a one-year extension. And now, by the time their contract runs out, we will allow a number of U.S. firms to bid on the third year of this contract.
And before I go to the other people here in the studio, Jim Kunder, I just wanted you to explain why, in the first place, when you erred on the side of going for a quick response, RTI was the right agency or the right organization to handle it.
Under federal procurement law, there's a very clear and specified process, and we are allowed to limit the number of firms who bid based on their previous competence. We had experience with RTI in other parts of the world. They had been a very productive contractor for the U.S. government, and so we looked at both their capabilities and cost and made the decision based on that according to law.
Kevin Bigas?
Quick thing, what's being left out of this is Jim has just told us the successes of the project, and Patrick's mentioned that. Over 2,000 Iraqis who worked for RTI on this project have been laid off in 2004 because USAID slashed funding last year. Now, that's something I've never gotten a clear answer from anyone, is if the project was doing so well and if it was so crucial, why these huge cutbacks to staff?
Let me turn to Patrick Hibbins as a spokesman for RTI. How do you respond
well,
to
Well, I think that really is a question for Jim. Clearly, we work within the parameters that they established within the scope of work for our contract. I know that they've been under well, I should just let Jim take that.
Right? Jim Kunder?
That's a very fair question by Mr. Bigas. What happened is things changed after a year. And first of all, let me explain what we're trying to do for your listeners' sake. I mean, we're trying to instill principles of democracy and stimulate local government and local participation. But, you know, these are busy, important local leaders in Iraq, and just having a bunch of American contractors show up in Baghdad or Basra or Najaf and sort of lecture on the elements of democracy is not the best way, we've found in many countries around the world, to get people engaged. The best way to get people engaged, as one of your panel members discussed earlier, is to give them practical hands-on experience. Let's not talk about democracy in the abstract. Let's talk about how we're going to clean up the sewage on the street. Let's talk about how we're going to rebuild the local school or playground. So what we did as part of RTI's task the first year was ask RTI to stimulate a lot of local government projects, a lot of playgrounds, a lot of street improvement projects. And the second year, we had found, as was indicated earlier, a lot of participation, a lot of interest, and we could throttle back on the number of local government projects because simultaneously with other elements of the U.S. Foreign Assistance Program in Iraq, we had gotten up to about 4,000 local government projects started through other organizations. So it was simply a recalibration of the program. And I know some folks got laid off, and we thought RTI responded very well to moving from the first stage, which is let's get local people involved by making practical projects the focus of our work, to by the second year moving to formal training of local boards and local officials as a more effective way of accomplishing the project's objectives.
So what then is next? I mean, what is the next winner of this contract going to have to do?
It's going to be more of the same, but it's going to be heavily involved in building local government competence. We are going to have a new government in Iraq. It's going to be elected this Sunday, and increasingly we're going to move from what was discussed earlier as the Coalition Provisional Authority, when the U.S. government actually ran the government of Iraq, to a more of a what we would call a bilateral relationship, the kind of relationship we have with India or Pakistan or Bangladesh. where we're going to be there trying to assist the Iraqis do what they want to do themselves. So I would say that a lot of what's going to be in the next year's contract is going to be determined in consultation with the newly elected Iraqi government. But I expect mostly it's going to continue to be building the competence of local officials so they can do the street work and school work and sewage treatment plant work, the nuts and bolts, not very glamorous work that people do across North Carolina and across the world.
Can I ask a question on this election that's coming up?
Go ahead, Tom Cook.
Yeah, I was wondering USA looks at this as being a direct election, as we would think of in this country. I mean, my understanding of the election that's taking place is not that it's going to be a direct election of people, but rather it's going to elect people who are then going to set the terms for a more universal kind of election that's going to take place sometime down the future, because you're going to have certain groups that simply aren't going to be involved in the election.
Jim Carter.
So I'm a little bit curious about how this is being billed as being an election that the Iraqi government's being elected. Is that the perception in Washington?
There's no confusion about this. We are involved in a multi-year transitional process in Iraq from complete dictatorship into what we hope will be a fully flourishing democracy. And just as we did in Afghanistan, that we took this a step at a time. And what you've got now is a vote for a transitional representative body, the primary function of which will be to do something that has never been done, which is to write a truly democratic constitution in Iraq. Then there will be a second stage when the public will have an opportunity to ratify that constitution, and then under that constitution, you'll have elected the permanent representative bodies in the new Iraqi government. So this is what it is. It is a very critical step, but a transitional step on the way to what we hope will be a full democracy in Iraq.
Jim Kunder, thanks so much. Jim Kunder is Assistant Administrator for Asia and the Near East at USAID in Washington. And Patrick Gibbons, I want to ask, is RTI going to be bidding for this contract that ends in the one that's going to come after the current one expires in March?
RTI has already submitted a proposal, and I think I should explain why we did that. We're very proud of the work that we've done in Iraq. We've worked alongside Iraqi officials, Iraqi citizens, and over the course of the last 18 to 19 months, we've developed very strong relationships. We've seen their commitment to democracy. We know that they want to move forward with democratic principles, particularly in local governance, because it's the first time government has ever been accountable to the people. They want water. They want lights. They want clean streets. They want the things that other people in other parts of the world want. Because of our commitment to that and because of our experience at this point, we feel is absolutely essential that we continue that relationship, but of course that's up to USAID, and we look forward to working with them or helping very smoothly transition to the next contractor who picks up this task.
Jay Price, just curious, in your estimation, is RTI just in the same position that the American government's in, and does that mean RTI shouldn't be there, or should they just deal with the security issues and the difficulties the way the government is?
Well, whether RTI should be there or not is you know, one of these things you should ask the administration. I mean, they're the ones who wanted somebody on the ground there. I think something that's not been discussed here is just the scope of this project. Nothing of this scope, of this type, has ever been tried before. This is a massive lab. And I challenge, you know, either Kevin or USAID or RTI to define success or failure here. I mean, you could write this story one way as chaos and just a fiasco, and you could write it as a resounding success. I mean, how do you measure success here? 14 units of democracy instilled into each individual in this town. It's a tough thing.
Kevin Bigos, I'll give you 10 seconds.
Hard to measure, but it does seem like the last year in Iraq has not gotten better. So the question is there a plan in place now for the future?
Hey, thanks everybody very much. Patrick Gibbons is with RTI International. Tom Cook also joined us. He's an independent international development advisor. Jay Price, a reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. Kevin Bigos is a reporter for the Winston-Salem Journal. That's the state of things for today, and thanks very much for listening. If you have a comment about our show, drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Rusty Jacobs.